and support where it could not at the cut. Though much is changed, I promise you, the result will be different this time.
Ander glanced momentarily at Alanon, but the druid said nothing. Pendannon came a step closer.
Ander, give me command in your father's stead. Let me set the defense as I know he would set it. The elves can hold the draw against those creatures, whatever their strength. Your father and I know,
Commander.
The elven prince spoke softly, firmly. I saw what the demons are capable of doing at Hallis Cut. I saw what they did to a defensive line that my father felt certain would hold them. This is a different sort of enemy we fight. It hates the elves beyond understanding. It is driven by that hatred, so much so that dying means nothing. Can we say the same? We to whom life is so precious?
I think not. We need something more than standard tactics if we are to survive this encounter.
Out of the corner of his eye, he caught Alanon's brief nod.
Pendannon bristled.
You lack faith, my lord prince. Your father would not be so quick.
Ander cut him short. My father is not here. But if he were, he would speak to you as I have spoken. I seek suggestions, Commander, not an argument.
Pendannon flushed darkly, then turned suddenly toward Alanon.
What is this one to say? Has he no thoughts to offer on how these demons are to be stopped?
Alanon's dark face was expressionless.
You cannot stop them, Commander. You can only slow them.
Slow them?
Slow them so that the bearer of the Elkris seed may gain time enough to find the bloodfire and return.
That again, Pendannon snorted. Our destiny in the hands of that girl. Druid, I do not believe in old world legends. If the Westland is to be saved, it must be saved through the courage of her men-at-arms, through the skill and experience of her soldiers. Demons may die as other things of flesh and blood.
Such as elves, the druid replied darkly.
There was a long silence. Pendannon turned away from the others, hands clasping angrily behind his back. After a moment, he wheeled back on them.
Do we stand at Bayendraw or not, Prince Ander? I hear no suggestions but my own.
Ander hesitated, wishing Alanon would say something. But it was Stee Jans who stepped forward, his rough voice breaking the silence.
My lord, may I speak?
Ander had almost forgotten that the Legion commander was there. He glanced at the big man and nodded.
My lord, the Free Corps has faced similar odds on more than one occasion while in the service of the Borderlands. It is a matter of pride with us that while our enemies have frequently been stronger than we, still we have survived and they have not. We have learned some hard lessons, my lord. I offer one of them to you now. It is this. Never settle a stationary defensive line where superior numbers will overrun you. We have learned to split our defensive front with a series of mobile lines that shift with the flow of battle. These lines attack and retreat in sequence, pulling the enemy first one way, then the other, striking always on the flanks as the enemy turns to repel each new assault, withdrawing beyond the enemy's reach when the strike is done.
Pendannon snorted.
Then you neither gain nor even hold ground, Commander.
Stee Jans turned to him.
When the enemy has been pulled far enough out in his efforts to catch you, when his lines have thinned and split, then you close ranks to either side and collapse on him.
Like so. He placed his hands in a V and brought them together with a clap. There was a startled silence.
I don't know, Pendannon muttered doubtfully.
How would you defend Bayendraw? Ander pressed.
I would use a variation of what I have just described to you, Stee Jans replied. Longbows on the slopes of the Kensrow over the mouth of the draw to harry the advance. Foot soldiers at its head,
as if you meant to hold it as you tried to hold Alice Cut. When the demons attack, stand for a time, then give way. Let them break through. Give them a rabbit to chase, a cavalry command to draw them on. When their lines are strung out, their flanks exposed, close on them from both sides, quickly, before they can fall back or be reinforced. Use lances to keep them from you. The demons lack our weapons. If you stay beyond their reach, they cannot harm you. When you have destroyed their front ranks, let the rabbit pull through a second rush. Take them another way. Keep them off balance. Concentrate on their flanks. He finished. The elves stared at the borderman. Pindanon frowned. Who would be the rabbit in this? Stijan smiled crookedly. Who else, Commander? Pindanon shrugged. Ander looked over at him questioningly. It might work, the old warrior admitted grudgingly. If the rabbit is any good, that is. The rabbit knows a few tricks, Stijan replied. That is why it is still alive after so many chases. Ander glanced quickly at Alanon. The druid nodded. Then we have our plan for the defense of the Sarindanon, the elven prince announced. His hand clasped Pindanon's, then that of the Iron Man. Let us make certain now that it succeeds. Later that night, when all was in readiness for the morrow's battle and he was alone, Ander Elicidal paused to reflect on how fortunate it was that Stijans had been present at his meeting with Pindanon. It was only then that it occurred to him that it might not have been good fortune at all, but a foresight peculiar to the enigmatic dark wanderer they knew as Alanon. Chapter 32 They buried Arion Elicidal at first light of dawn. His brother, Pindanon, and 4 dozen of the home guard interred him in the traditional manner of the elves, at the birth of the new day, at the time of beginning. They bore him in silence to an oak-shaded bluff below Baon Draw that looked west over the blue expanse of the Innisbor and east across the green valley of the Sarindanon. There the firstborn of Eventine Elicidal was laid to rest. His body returned to the earth that had given it life, his spirit set free once more. They left no marker to the Crown Prince. Alanon had warned that there were some among the demons who would search out such testaments and prey upon the dead. There were no songs, no words of praise, no flowers. Nothing to show that Arion Elicidal had ever been. There remained nothing of Eventine's firstborn but memories. Ander saw the tears in the eyes of those who gathered with him and felt that memories might be enough. Less than an hour later, the demons attacked the elves at Baon Draw. Down out of the northern hills they streamed, their screams and howls shattering the stillness of the dawn. They came as they had come at Halla's Cut, a mass of twisted dark bodies surging forward like the unleashed waters of a flood. At the lower end of the draw, the elven phalanx waited, rows of lancers and pikemen standing shoulder to shoulder with weapons braced. As the foremost demons clawed their way toward them, elven longbows hummed along the slopes of the Kensrow, and the air was filled with feathered arrows. Demons convulsed and fell, buried beneath those who came after. Wave after wave of dark shafts ripped through their ranks, and hundreds died in the rush. But at last the phalanx was reached, and the demons flung themselves against it, shrieking with pain as the iron-tipped shafts pierced their bodies and held them transfixed. The attack faltered and was thrown back. Again it came, a sudden surge forward of malformed bodies, teeth and claws ripping, and again it was thrown back. The ground before the elven defensive wall grew littered with dead and dying. Still, the horde of demons pressed ahead, endless in number, and at last the elven line wavered and broke, its center seeming to fall away. Into the breach surged the demons, bounding and leaping and scrambling from the draw. Instantly they were set upon by a body of horsemen, gray-cloaked riders with crimson trim, their leader a tall, scar-faced man on a giant blue roan. The riders swept across the head of the demon rush, lances scything. Then they were gone, turning back into the valley, gray cloaks flying, lean forms bent low over their mounts as they galloped away. The demons gave chase in a frenzy. Moments later, the riders came about, charging back into their pursuers, lances lowered, scattering bodies as again they struck and swung quickly away. The demons howled their frustration and scrambled after them. Then suddenly the gray-cloaked riders wheeled in a solid line that barred the demons' path forward, and the arm of the scar-faced man lifted. No longer massed protectively but strung out along the grasslands for hundreds of yards beyond the mouth of Bayon Draw, the demons who had breached the elven defensive line stared about wildly, seeing now what had been done to them. To either side, lines of elven cavalry burst into view, hemming them in like cattle. Behind them, the breach had been closed by a tall, black-robed figure standing atop the lower slopes of the Kensrow, with fire spurting from his outstretched hands to scatter the demons who milled uncertainly within the draw. Desperately, those trapped without sought to break the lines about them, but the elves converged quickly, sword and lance cutting apart the black forms that reached up for them. In moments, the whole of the demon advance had been destroyed. Through the length of the Bayon Draw, the elven cry of victory echoed. It did not end there. For the remainder of the morning and into early afternoon, the battle raged on. Time and again the demons massed for a rush on the elven phalanx that barred passage through Bayon Draw. Time and again they broke through, battling their way past elven archers and druid fire, past lancers and pikemen, only to find themselves face to face with the gray riders of the Legion Free Corps. Teased and harassed, they gave chase. Heedless of what lay ahead, they allowed themselves to be drawn on, sometimes toward the shoreline of the Innisbore, sometimes toward the slopes of the Kensrow, or into the valley of the Serendanon. Then, when it appeared that they had caught the elusive horsemen, they found themselves encircled by elven cavalry, their own ranks thinned and unprotected, their thrust having carried them far from those brethren who battled still within the draw. Raging, they threw themselves at their enemy, but there was no escape. The elves swept back, and again their lines closed across Bayon Draw. For a time the demons sought to gain the slopes of the Kensrow, thinking to put an end to the hated longbows. But carefully placed, their ranks deep and sheltered within the rocks, the elven archers cut to pieces those who tried to reach them. In their midst stood the black-robed giant, sorcerous fire lancing from his hands, his awesome power sheltering the elves who struggled below. All forms of demons tried to reach him, demons that burrowed within the earth, demons that flew, demons that scaled cliff walls like flies. All failed, all died. In one attack, the demons smashed through the elven phalanx where it bordered the shoreline of the Innisbore, turning it back across the draw as hundreds of attackers swarmed over the sand-swept hills toward the open valley beyond. For a moment, it appeared that the elven defensive line was finally broken. But with a valiant effort, the cavalry converged east of this new advance and rode into it in a charge that drove the demons back into the waters of the Innisbore. Again the evil ones could not mass, but were strung out along the beachhead, their backs to the lake. The attack faltered and broke apart, shattered on the lances of the elves. The breach closed one time more. Thousands of demons died that afternoon in senseless, mindless, savage rushes through Bayon Draw. They attacked ceaselessly, surging forward on their race to the cliffs with the blind determination of lemmings, oblivious to the destruction that waited. Elves and bordermen died with them, caught up in their frenzy to break through to the Serendanon. Yet the rout that had occurred at Halla's Cut was not repeated this day. Time and again the demons were thrown back, the forefront of their assault destroyed before it had an opportunity to gain reinforcement from the masses that came after. Finally, in mid-afternoon, the demons launched their final attack. Massing within Bayon Draw, they surged against the elven phalanx, bore it backward by sheer force of numbers, and snapped it apart. Into the seams they poured, and suddenly there was no time for carefully wrought tactics or for skill and finesse. The elves and the legion struck back, their horsemen charging into the midst of the onslaught. Sword and spear cut deep into the tangle of twisted dark forms below. Horses and riders screamed and went down. The lines of fighters surged back and forth desperately. But at last the demons broke, snarling and clawing as they fled back into the draw, shrieks of anger rising from their midst. This time they did not turn. They continued on, trampling through their own dead and dying, hobbling and crawling and scrambling into the hills beyond, until Bayon Draw stood empty. The elves stared after the retreating forms in weary disbelief, watching as the last of them disappeared into the curve of the hills, the sound of their passing fading slowly into silence. Then the elves looked about them and saw clearly the enormity of the struggle that had taken place. Thousands of tangled dark bodies lay scattered across the grasslands, spreading east out of Bayon Draw from Kensro to Innisbor, still and lifeless and broken. The draw itself was massed thick with them. The elves were appalled. It was as if life had meant nothing to the demons, as if death were somehow preferable. Eyes began to search out the faces of friends and comrades. Hands stretched out to one another, clasping tightly, and the elves were filled with relief, grateful that they had somehow survived through such terrible destruction. At the head of the draw, Andor Elicidal found Kael Pindannon and impulsively hugged the veteran soldier to him. Cries of elation began to rise from the throats of their countrymen as the realization set in that the day was theirs. Stejans rode in at the head of the Free Corps, and the bordermen joined the elves, lances raising in salute. Down the length of the Serendanon, the roar of victory swelled and echoed. Only Alanon stood apart. Alone now on the slopes of the Kensro, his dark face turned north toward the hills into which the demons had so abruptly fled, he found himself wondering why it was that they had been willing to give their lives so cheaply, and, perhaps more important still, why it was that through all that slaughter there had been no sign of the one they called the Dagda Mor. The afternoon faded into dusk, and the night slipped silently away. At the mouth of Bayon Draw, the army of the Westland waited for the demons to attack. But the demons did not come. Nor did they come at dawn, though elves and bordermen stood ready once more. The morning hours began to creep past, and a growing uneasiness pervaded the ranks of the defenders. At midday, Andor went looking for Alanon, hoping that the druid could give some explanation for what was happening. Alone, he climbed the slopes of the Kensro to where Alanon kept a solitary vigil within the shelter of an outcropping of rock, half hidden in shadow as he gazed out across the Serendanon. The elven prince had not spoken with Alanon since yesterday when the druid had come up into these mountains. No one had. Caught up in the jubilation of the elven victory over the demons, he had given little thought to the druid's going. After all, Alanon came and went all the time, seldom with any explanation. But now, as he approached the druid, he found himself wondering, nevertheless, why Alanon had chosen this time to be alone. He was given his answer the moment the druid turned to face him. Al-Anon's face, once so dark, was ashen. Harsh lines creased the skin, giving it a slack and weary cast, and there was a brooding look to the piercing black eyes. Ander drew up short, staring. The stare brought a faint smile to Al-Anon's lips. "Does something trouble you, Elven Prince?" Ander started. "No, it's just that... Al-Anon, you look..." The druid shrugged. "There is a price for the ways in which we use ourselves. That is one of nature's laws, though we often choose to disregard it. Even a druid is subject to its dictates." He paused. "Do you understand what I am saying?" Ander looked uncertain. "The magic does this to you?" Al-Anon nodded. "The magic takes life from the user. It drains strength and being. Something of what is lost can be recovered, but recovery is slow. And there is pain." The sentence died away, unfinished. Ander felt a sudden chill. "Al-Anon, have you lost the magic?" The cowled head lifted. "The magic is not lost while the user lives. But there are limits that cannot be exceeded, and the limits shorten with the passing of the years. We all grow old, Elven Prince." "Even you?" Ander asked quietly. The black eyes were veiled. Al-Anon changed the subject abruptly. "What brings you to me?" Ander took a moment to recover his thoughts. "I came to ask why the demons do not attack." The druid looked away. "Because they are not yet ready." He was silent a moment, then his gaze shifted back again. "Do not be misled. They will come. They but delay, and there is a purpose behind that delay. The one who leads them, the one who is called the Dagdamor, does nothing without reason." He bent forward slightly. "Give thought to this. The Dagdamor was not among those who attacked us yesterday." Ander frowned worriedly. "Where was he then?" Al-Anon shook his head. "The question we should be asking is, where is he now?" He watched Ander for a moment, then drew the black robes close about him. "I have been thinking that it would be wise to send trackers north above the Kensrow and south below the Innisbor to be certain that the demons do not intend to flank us." There was a long silence. "Are there demons enough to do that?" Ander asked finally, thinking of the thousands that had come against them already at Bay and Draw. Al-Anon's laugh was brittle. "Demons enough." The druid turned away. "Leave me alone now, Elven Prince." Ander went back down out of the Kensrow, riddled with doubt. On his return, trackers were dispatched and the waiting resumed. Morning passed into afternoon and afternoon into evening. A heavy bank of clouds rolled across the darkening sky, and shadows lengthened quickly into night. Still, the demons did not come. It was nearing midnight when the attack finally came. It was sudden, so sudden that the sentries standing watch had barely enough time to give the alarm before the first of the demons were upon them. They came through Bay and Draw in a massive rush, waves of black, corded bodies surging down out of the darkened northern hills into the light of the watchfires. One by one, the fires winked out, smothered by the demons as they swept through the draw and onto the slopes of the Kensrow. With the watchfires gone and the night sky screened by the clouds that had swept east out of the break line, the whole of Bay and Draw was plunged into blackness. It was a blackness that the demons knew well, to which they had grown accustomed during the time of their imprisonment within the Forbidding, a darkness that would be made to serve them. for while the elves and the Southlanders could now see little, the demons saw as if it were brightest day. Shrieking in frenzied anticipation, they attacked. At the head of the draw, rallying about Andor Elicidal and the gleaming white staff of the Elcris, an elven phalanx met the rush. The impact threw the soldiers backward, yet they held their lines. Hundreds of dark bodies crushed up against them, teeth and claws ripping. The elves fought back determinedly, lances and pikes thrusting blindly into the mass of demons that pushed forward, and screams of pain tore through the night. But the demons kept coming, surging into the elves, struggling to break apart their defense. For a few desperate minutes, the elves withstood the savage rush, holding back the masses that hurtled against them. But the darkness confused and hindered them. In the end, they were overwhelmed. The phalanx began to give, falling back raggedly, splitting apart. Seconds later, the demons broke through. That would have been the finish, if not for Alanon. Gaining the lower slopes of the Kensrow, where the elven archers fought a losing battle in the darkness to keep back the onrushing demons, the druid seized a handful of glittering dust from a small pouch tied at his waist and tossed the dust high into the air. Instantly the dust spread out across the night sky above the struggling elves, filling the darkness with a brilliant white glow that lit the land beneath with the brightness of moonlight. Gone was the blackness and the demon's concealment. From behind the broken phalanx, a rallying cry went up. Into the main breach, where the largest mass of demons thrust forward, rode Stee Jans and the men of the Legion Free Corps. Like an iron wedge, they split the forefront of the assault. Less than 400 now, they hammered into the horde before them and bore it back toward the mouth of Baen Draw. To their aid galloped the elven cavalry, Kael Pindanon leading, head bare, white hair flying. All along the shattered defensive line, the lances of the horsemen tore into the advancing demons and drove them back. On the slopes of the Kensrow, the demons had broken through the ranks of archers and were pouring down into the Serendanon. Alanon stood virtually alone in their path, blue fire lancing from his hands. They came at him from everywhere, howling in frenzy as the fire burned them to ash. The druid did not give way. When they grew too many for him, he turned the whole of the grasslands about him for hundreds of feet in either direction into an inferno of death, a wall of blue fire that ringed the maddened demons and destroyed any that tried to breach it. 100 yards back from the mouth of Baen Draw, the elves and the Free Corps fought desperately to keep the main body of demons from breaking through into the Serendanon. It was a terrible, frightening battle, and the smell of death filled the summer night. At its height, Kael Pindanon went down, his horse stumbling beneath him. The old warrior was shaken and came to his feet unsteadily, fumbling for his broadsword. Instantly the demons were upon him, howling. Elven hunters fought to reach their beleaguered commander, slashing and cutting their way through the demons that rose before them. But the demons were too quick. Clawed hands reached for Pindanon, warding off the blows struck at them, and the old soldier was pulled to his death. At the same moment, a handful of demons broke from the crush of fighters about them and hurtled toward Andor Elicidal. Through the ring of home guard that battled about him, the demons came, bounding like cats, to lunge for the elven prince. In desperation, he brought up the Elcris staff like a shield, and his attackers shrank from it, howling with rage. But Andor was all alone now, surrounded by twisted black forms, and they snapped and tore at him, waiting for a chance to break through the guard of his talisman. Elven hunters fought desperately to reach the prince, yet the demons blocked their way, tearing apart those who came too close, parrying wildly the cut and slash of lance and sword. Their brethren surged to their aid, seeing that they had within their grasp the bearer of the hated talisman. Clawed hands reached out, grasping. Then through the tangle of fighters hurtled a giant, scar-faced border man, gray-cloaked body streaked with dirt and blood. Up against the demons he went, cutting through corded black bodies with great sweeps of his broadsword until at last he stood next to Ander. Shrieks of rage rose from the demons, and they threw themselves at him. But Stee Jans held his ground like some immovable rock, keeping Ander's attackers from him as he called to his bordermen. They came instantly, riding to his aid, gathering about him in a circle of iron. Then he was back atop his roan, sword lifted. The gray riders charged forward, their battle cry ringing out through the night. For an instant, Ander did not realize what was happening. Then, through the hazy glow of false moonlight, he caught sight of the men of the Free Corps, Stee Jans at their head, red hair flying, one hand gripping the great broadsword, the other the Free Corps standard of battle. Alone, a handful against hundreds, the Free Corps was attacking. At once the elven prince seized the reins of a riderless horse, mounted, then spurred the animal ahead, crying out to his countrymen. As the elves rallied to him from every quarter, he rode into the ranks of the demons, forward to the side of the Legion Free Corps. In a wave, the elves and the bordermen swept down into Bayendraw, driving the demons before them. Like men gone berserk, they battered their way ahead, horsemen and foot soldiers with lance and pike and sword, shouting as one the battle cries of their homelands. For an instant the demons stood their ground, shrieking with rage and hate, tearing at the madmen who thrust so recklessly into their midst. But the big man with the broadsword and the Free Corps battle standard had given fresh courage to the elves, courage that bore them forward to face death without fear, to forget everything but their determination to destroy utterly those twisted black forms that stood before them. The demons wavered and fell back, slowly at first, then in headlong flight, for the fury generated within the army of the elves was much greater now than their own. Into the hills north they fled once more, scrambling down from the slopes of the Kensrow through the rocks and crags of the draw, flying into the concealing shadows of the night. In moments, Bayendraw had been cleared, and the Serendanon was again in the hands of the elves. Ander Elicital sat within his tent, stripped to the waist, as elven hunters worked on the wounds the demons had inflicted upon him during the battle. He sat in silence, his body aching with fatigue and the pain of his injuries. Messengers came and went, reporting on the progress of the army as it prepared to entrench once more across the mouth of Bayendraw. Home guard ringed the tent, the iron of their weapons glinting in the light of the watchfires. The elven prince had finished with the bandaging and was pulling on his armor when the tent flaps parted suddenly, and Stee Jans appeared out of the night, his giant form streaked with dirt and ash and blood. Those within the tent immediately fell silent. With a single word, Ander bade them all leave. The tent emptied, and Ander moved forward to stand before the borderman. Wordlessly, he clasped the big man's hand in his own. "You saved all of us tonight, Commander," he said quietly. "There is a debt owed you that will be difficult to repay." Stee Jans studied him a moment, then shook his head slowly. "My lord, there is nothing owed to me. I am a soldier. Anything I did this night was no more than I should have done." Ander smiled wearily. "You will never convince me of that. Still, I respect and admire you far too much to argue the matter. I will simply thank you." He released the big man's hand and stepped back. "Kaol Pindanon is dead, and I must find a new field commander. I want you." The borderman was quiet a moment. "My lord, I am not an elf, nor even of this country. I have no elf nor countryman better suited to command this army than you," Ander replied at once. and it was your plan that enabled us to hold Baen Draw.
Stijans did not drop his gaze. There are some who would question this decision.
There are some who would question any decision. Anders shook his head.
I am not my father, nor my brother, nor the leader they thought to have. But be that as it may, the decision is mine to make, and I have made it. I want you as field commander. Do you accept?
The borderman thought for a long time before he spoke again.
I do.
Ander felt a bit of the weariness slip from him.
Then let us begin.
A sudden movement in the shadows by the entry brought them both about with a start. Alanon stood there, his iron face grim.
The trackers sent north and south within the valley have returned.
The druid spoke softly, the words almost a hiss as they left his mouth.
Those who went south along the Innisbor found nothing, but those who went north encountered an army of demons so massive as to dwarf that which battles us within Baen Draw. It comes south along the eastern wall of the Kensro. Already it will have entered the Serendanon.
Ander Elicidal stared silently at the big man, hope fading within his eyes.
This was their plan from the beginning, Elven Prince, to engage you here at Baen Draw with the lesser force while the greater skirted the Kensro north, to come down into the Serendanon from behind, thereby trapping the army of the elves between the two. Had you not sent those trackers?
He trailed off meaningfully. Ander started to speak and stopped, choking on the words.
Suddenly there were tears in his eyes, tears of rage and frustration.
All the men who have died here and at Hela's Cut, my brother, Pindanin, all dead that the Serendanon might behold. Is there nothing we can do?
The army that comes down out of the north contains demons whose powers far exceed anything you have yet encountered.
Alanon's head shook slowly.
Too much power, I am afraid, for you to withstand. Too much. If you try to hold the Serendanon longer, if you attempt to stand here at Baen Draw, or even to fall back to some other line of defense within the valley, you shall most certainly be destroyed.
Ander's youthful face was bleak.
Then the Serendanon is lost.
Alanon nodded slowly. The elven prince hesitated, glancing back momentarily toward the rear compartment of the tent where the king still lay unconscious, unknowing, locked in dreamless sleep, far from the pain and the reality that confronted his anguished son.
Lost. The break line, the Serendanon, his family, his army, everything.
Within, he felt himself breaking apart. Alanon's hand gripped his shoulder.
Without turning, he nodded.
We shall leave at once.
Head bowed, he walked from the tent to give the order.
Chapter 33 Will Ohmsford found the Wilderun as bleak and forbidding as the stories had foretold. Though the afternoon sky had been brilliant with sunlight when he and Amberley had left the Roxburgh, the Wilderun was a tangle of shadows and murky darkness, screened away from the world about it by trees and scrub that was twisted and interwoven until there seemed to be neither beginning nor end to its maze. Trunks thick with mold grew gnarled and bent, the limbs coiling out like spiders' legs, choked with vines and brush, heavy with spiny leaves that shimmered in streaks of incandescent silver. Dead wood and scrub littered the valley floor, decaying slowly in the dark ground, giving it an unpleasantly soft, spongy feel. Damp with must and rot, the Wilderun had the look of something misshapen and grotesque. It was as if nature had stunted the land and the life that grew within it, then bent it down within itself so that it might ever be made to breathe
eat and drink the stench that rose out of its own slow death. Down the crooked forest road the Veilman walked, the elven girl close beside him, peering into the darkness about them with cautious, worried eyes, hearing distantly the sounds of the life that prowled and hunted within. The road was like a tunnel, walled about by forest, lighted only by faint streamers of sunlight that somehow slipped past the tangle overhead to touch faintly the dank earth below. There were no birds within this forest. Will had noticed that at once. Birds would not live within such blackness, Will had thought to himself, not while they might fly in sunlight. There were none of the usual small forest animals, nor even such common insects as brightly colored butterflies. What lived here were things best left to blackness, night, and shadow. Bats, leathered and reeking of disease, snakes and scaled hunters that nested and fed on vermin that lived within fetid ponds and marsh, cat things, sleek and quick as they stalked the treeways on silent pads. A time or two their shadows crossed the roadway, and Veilman and Elven Girl paused guardedly. Yet as quickly as they had come, they were gone again, lost in the blackness, leaving the humans on the empty path to stare anxiously at the forests and to hurry on. Once, when they had gone deep into the gloom, the pair heard something massive move, pushing through trees as if it were pushing through fragile twigs, its breath huffing loudly in the stillness that fell across the forest with its passing. Lumbering invisibly through the gloom, it either did not see or did not care to bother with the two small creatures who stood frozen upon the trail. Slowly, deliberately, it moved off. In the silence that followed, Veilman and Elven Girl fled quickly away. They encountered only a handful of travelers as they walked the forest, all but one afoot, and that one slouched atop a horse so thin and worn as to appear more an apparition than flesh and blood. Cloaked and hooded, the travelers passed them by singly and in pairs, offering no greeting. Yet within the shadow of their cowls, their heads turned and their eyes blinked with the cold interest of cats, staring after the intruders as if to measure their purpose. Chilled by those looks, the Southlander and the girl found themselves glancing back over their shoulders long after the cloaked forms had disappeared from view. It was nearing sunset when they passed at last from the gloom of the wilderness forest into the town of Grimpen Ward. A less inviting community would have been hard to imagine. Set down within a hollow, Grimpen Ward was a ramshackle cluster of wooden plank buildings, so closely jammed together as to be nearly indistinguishable one from the other. They were a seedy lot, these shops and stalls, inns and taverns. The garish paint that colored them was chipped and faded. Many stood shuttered, bars drawn, locks fastened. Poorly lettered signs hung from swaying posts and over doors, a patchwork maze of promises and prices beneath proprietors' names. Through windows and entryways, lamps of oil and pitch burned, casting their harsh yellow light into the shadows without as dusk closed down about the hollow. It was in the taverns and inns of Grimpen Ward that her denizens were gathered, at rough-hewn tables and bars formed of boards set atop barrels, about glasses and tankards of ale and wine, their voices loud and rough, their laughter shrill. They drifted from one building to the next, hard-eyed men and women of all races, some dressed gaily, some ragged, bold in the glare of the lamplight, or furtive as they stole through alleyways, many stumbling, lurching, and reeking of drink. Money clinked and changed hands quickly, often in stealth or in violence. Here a lumpish figure slumped down within a doorway, asleep in drunken stupor, his clothes stripped from his body, his purse gone. There a tattered form lay still and twisted within a darkened passage, the lifeblood seeping from the wound at his throat. All about, dogs prowled, ragged and hungry, slinking through the shadows like wraiths.
thieves and cutthroats, harlots and cheats, traitors in life and death and false pleasure. Will Ohmsford felt the hair on the back of his neck rise. Perk's grandfather had been right about Grimpen Ward. Holding tight to Amberley's hand, he followed the rutted line of the road as it wound through the tangle of buildings. What were they to do now? Certainly they could not go back into the forest, not at night. He was reluctant to remain in Grimpen Ward, but what other choice did they have? They were both tired and hungry. It had been days since they had slept in a bed or eaten a hot meal. Still, there seemed to be little chance that they would get either here. Neither of them had any money to buy or anything of value to trade for a night's food and lodging. Everything had been lost in their flight out of the Picon. The Veilmen had thought to find someone within the town who might be persuaded to let them work for a meal and a bed, but what he saw about him suggested that no one of that disposition lived in Grimpen Ward. A drunken gnome lurched up against him and fumbled for his cloak. Will shoved the fellow away hurriedly. The gnome tumbled into the street and lay laughing foolishly at the sky. The Veilman stared down at him a moment, then clasped Amberley's arm and hurried on. There were other problems facing them as well. Once they left Grimpen Ward, how were they to find their way from there? How were they to keep from becoming quickly lost within the wilderness beyond? They desperately needed someone to guide them, but whom in Grimpen Ward could they trust? If they were forced to continue on without any idea of where they were going, then it would become necessary for Will to use the Elfstones, or at least attempt to use them, before they had found the tunnels of Safehold and the Bloodfire, and long before they were ready to flee. The moment he did that, he would bring the demons down on them. Yet without the use of the stones or the aid of a guide, they would have no choice at all of finding Safehold, not if they had all year to do so instead of only days. Will paused helplessly, staring at the lighted doors and windows of the buildings of the town, the shadowy figures who milled within, and the backdrop of the wilderness and the night sky. It was an impossible dilemma, and he had no idea at all how he was going to resolve it. Will, Amberley tugged anxiously at his arm. Let's get off the street. The Veilman glanced at her quickly and nodded. First things first. They must find a place to sleep for the night. They must have something to eat. The rest would have to wait. With Amberley's hand in his, he started back up the roadway, studying the inns and taverns at either side. They walked about 50 feet further before the Veilman caught sight of a small two-story lodging house set back from the other buildings within a grove of scrub pine. Lights burned through the windows of the first floor while the second story stood dark. The loud voices and raucous laughter were missing here, or at least diminished, and the crowd was small. Will moved over to the courtyard fronting the inn and peered through the streaked glass of the windows opening on the main room. Everything appeared quiet. He glanced up. The sign on the gatepost indicated it was the Candlelight Inn. He hesitated a moment longer, then made up his mind. With a reassuring nod to Amberley, who looked more than a little doubtful, he led her through the gate and moved up the walk through the pine. The inn doors stood open to the summer night. "Put your cowl about your face," he whispered suddenly, and when she stared over at him blankly, quickly did so for her. He gave her a smile which belied his own sense of uncertainty, then took her hand firmly in his and stepped through the entry. The room within was cramped and thick with smoke from oil lamps and pipes. A short bar stood at the front, and a knot of rough-looking men and women clustered about it, talking among themselves and drinking ale. Various tables ringed by chairs and backless stools filled the back, a few occupied by cloaked figures who hunched over drinks and spoke in low voices. Several doors led from this room to other parts of the building, and a stairway ran up the left wall and disappeared into darkness. The floor was splintered and worn, and cobwebs hung from the corners of the ceiling. Next to the doorway, an aged hound chewed contentedly on a meat bone. Will guided Amberlee to the back of the room where a small table stood empty save for a fat, low-burning candle, and they seated themselves. A few heads lifted or turned as they passed, then just as quickly looked away again.
"What are we doing here?" Amberlee asked anxiously, finding it difficult to keep the tone of her voice low enough that they would not be overheard.
Will shook his head. "Just be patient." A few moments later, a lumpish, unfriendly-looking woman of uncertain age trudged over to them, a towel thrown loosely across one arm. As she came up to them, Will noticed that she was limping badly. He thought he recognized that limp, and the germ of an idea began to form.
"Something to drink?" she wanted to know.
Will smiled pleasantly.
"Two glasses of ale."
The woman walked away without comment. Will watched her go.
"I do not like ale," Amberlee protested. "What are you doing?"
"Being sociable."
"Did you notice the way that woman limped?"
The elven girl stared at him.
"What has that got to do with anything?"
Will smiled.
"Everything. Watch and see."
They sat in silence for a moment, then the woman was back again, carrying with her the glasses of ale. She placed them on the table and stood back, her beefy hand passing through a string of tangled, graying hair.
"That all?"
"Do you have any dinner?" Will wanted to know, taking a sip of the ale.
Amberlee ignored her glass entirely.
"Stew, bread, cheese, maybe some cakes. Fresh today."
Hot day for baking.
"Real hot. Waste of effort, too. No one's eating."
Will shook his head sympathetically.
"Shouldn't let that kind of effort go to waste."
"Most would rather drink," the heavy woman offered with a snort.
"Me too, I guess, if I had the time."
Will grinned.
"I suppose. Do you run the inn alone?"
"Me and my boys."
She warmed a bit, folding her arms across her chest.
"Husband run off. Boys help me when they're not drinking or gambling, which is seldom. I could do it myself if it weren't for this leg. Cramps up all the time. Hurts like there's no quitting."
"Have you tried heat on it?"
"Sure. Helps some.
Herb mixes?"
She spat. "Worthless."
"Quite a problem. How long has it been that way?"
Years, I guess. I lost count. Doesn't do any good thinking about it."
"Well."
Will looked thoughtful.
"The food sounds good.
I think we will try it. A plate for each of us." The proprietress of the Candlelight Inn nodded and moved away again. Amberlee leaned forward quickly.
"How do you plan to pay for all this? We don't have any money."
"I know that," the veilman replied, glancing about.
"I don't think we are going to need any."
Amberlee looked as if she were going to hit him.
"You promised you would not do this again. You promised you would tell me first what it was you were planning to do before you did it. Remember? The last time you tried something like this was with the Rovers, and it nearly cost us our lives. These people look a lot more dangerous than the Rovers." I know, but I just thought of it. We have to have a meal and a bed, and this looks like our best chance for both."
The elven girl's face tightened within the shadow of the cowl.
"I do not like this place, Will Ohmsford. This inn, this town, these people, any of it. We could do without the meal and the bed."
Will shook his head.
"We could, but we won't. Shh, she's coming back."
The woman had returned with their dinner. She set the steaming plates before them and was about to leave when Will spoke.
"Stay a moment," he asked.
The proprietress turned back to them.
"I've been thinking about your leg. Maybe I can help."
She stared at him suspiciously. What do you mean? He shrugged.
Well, I think I can stop the pain.
The look of suspicion grew more pronounced.
Why would you want to do that for me?
She scowled.
Will smiled. Business? Money?
I don't have much money.
Then how about a trade? For the price of the ale, this meal, and a night's lodging, I'll stop the pain. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Her lumpish body dropped heavily into the chair next to him.
But can you do it?
Bring out a cup of hot tea and a clean cloth, and we will see. The woman came to her feet at once and lumbered off to the kitchen. Will watched her go, smiling faintly. Amberley shook her head.
I hope you know what you are doing.
So do I.
Eat your dinner now in case I don't.
They had finished most of their meal by the time she returned with the tea and cloth. Will glanced past her to the patrons gathered about the bar. A few heads were beginning to turn. Whatever happened next, he thought, he did not want to call further attention to himself. He looked up at the woman and smiled.
This should be done in private. Do you have somewhere we might go?
The woman shrugged and led them through one of the closed doors into a small room containing a single table with a candle and six stools. She lit the candle and closed the door. The three seated themselves.
What happens now? The woman asked.
The veilman took a single dried leaf from a pouch about his waist and crumpled it into dust, dropping the dust into the tea. He stirred the mixture about, then handed it back to the woman.
Drink it down. It will make you a bit sleepy, nothing more.
The woman studied it a moment, then drank it. When the cup was empty, Will took it from her, dropped in another kind of leaf, and poured a small measure of ale from his glass, which he had carried in with him. These he stirred slowly, watching the leaf dissolve away to nothing. Across the table from him, Amberley shook her head.
Put your leg up on this stool, Will ordered, shoving a vacant stool in front of the woman, who dutifully placed her leg on it. Now, pull up your skirt.
The proprietress gave him a questioning look, as if wondering what his intentions might be for her, then hiked her skirt up to her thigh. Her leg was corded, veined, and covered with dark splotches. Will dipped the cloth into the mixture in the cup and began rubbing it into the leg.
Tingles a bit.
The woman giggled. Will smiled encouragingly. When the mixture was gone from the cup, he reached into the pouch once more and this time produced a long silver needle with a rounded head. The woman leaned forward with a start.
You're not going to stick that in me, are you?
Will nodded calmly.
You won't feel it. Just a touch.
He passed it slowly through the flame of the candle that burned at the center of their table.
Now, hold very still, he ordered.
Slowly, carefully, he inserted the needle into the woman's leg, just above the knee joint, until only the rounded head was showing. He left it there a moment, then withdrew it. The woman grimaced slightly, shut her eyes, then opened them again. Will sat back.
All done, he announced, hoping that indeed it was. Stand up and walk about.
The perplexed woman stared at him a moment, then pulled down her skirt indignantly and rose to her feet. Gingerly she stepped away from the table, testing the feel of the bad leg. Then abruptly she wheeled about, a broad grin creasing her rough face.
It's gone. The pain's gone. First time in months.
She was laughing excitedly.
I don't believe it. How'd you do that?
Magic. Will grinned with satisfaction, then immediately wished he hadn't said that. Amberley shot him an angry glance.
Magic, huh?
The woman took a few more steps, shaking her head.
Well, if you say so, it sure feels like magic. No pain at all.
Well,
It wasn't really magic, Will began anew, but the woman was already moving toward the door. I feel so good, I'm going to give everyone a free glass. She opened the door and stepped through. Can't wait to see their faces when they hear about this. No, wait, Will called after her, but the door closed and she was gone. Confound it, he muttered, wishing belatedly that he had made her promise to keep quiet about this. Amberlee folded her hands calmly and looked at him. How did you do that? He shrugged. I'm a healer, remember? The store's taught me a few things about aches and pains. He leaned forward conspiratorially. The trouble is, the treatment doesn't last. Doesn't last? Amberlee was horrified. Will put a finger to his lips. The treatment is only temporary. By morning the pain will be back, so we had better be gone. Will, you lied to that woman, the elven girl cried. You told her you could cure her. No, that was not what I said. I said that I could stop the pain. I did not say for how long. A night's relief for her. A night's sleep and a meal for us. A fair trade. Amberlee stared at him accusingly and did not reply. Will sighed. If it is any comfort to you, the pain will not be as bad as it was before. But her condition is not one that any healer could cure. It has to do with the life she leads, her age, her weight, a lot of other things over which I have no control. I have done as much as I can for her. Will you please be reasonable? Could you give her something for when the pain returns? The veilman reached over and gripped her hands. You are a truly gentle person, do you know that? Yes, I could give her something for the pain, but we will leave it for her to find after we are gone, if you don't mind. A sudden clamor from the other room brought him to his feet, and he moved to the door, slipping it open just a crack. Before, the inn had been all but empty. Now it was nearly filled as people drifted in off the roadway, attracted by the promise of free drinks and the antics of the proprietress, who was gleefully demonstrating her newfound cure. Time to be going, Will muttered, and hurriedly led Amberlee from the room. They had not taken a dozen steps when the woman called out shrilly and came rushing over to stop them. Heads shook and fingers pointed at Will. Too many for the veilman's comfort. A glass of ale, you too, the heavy woman offered. Her hand clapped Will on the shoulder and nearly knocked him off his feet. He managed a weak grin. I think we should get some sleep. We have a long journey, and we are really very tired. The woman snorted. Stay up and celebrate. You don't have to pay. Drink all you want. Will shook his head. I think we better get some sleep. Sleep? With all this noise? The woman shrugged. Take room number 10, top of the stairs and down the hall. Sit to the back of the inn. Might be a little more quiet for you. She paused. We're even now, right? I don't owe you anything more. Nothing, Will assured her, anxious to be gone. The proprietress grinned broadly. Well, you sold out cheap, you know that? I would have paid you 10 times what you asked for what you've done. Why, a couple hours without the pain is worth the ale and the meal and the bed. You got to be clever if you expect to get anywhere in this country. Remember that bit of advice, little elf. It's free. She laughed roughly and turned back to the bar. The free drinks were over. With a crowd of this size, there was money to be made. The woman scurried along the serving board, snatching the coins up eagerly. Will grabbed Amberlee's arm and guided her away from the table to the stairway and up the steps. The stares of the patrons followed after them. And you were worried about her, the veilman muttered as they reached the upper hallway and turned down it. Amberlee smiled and said nothing.
Chapter 34. They had been asleep several hours when they heard the noises at the door of their room. Will came awake first, sitting upright in the bed with a start, peering through the deep night blackness. He could hear sounds without, a shuffling of feet, whispered voices, heavy breathing. Not demons, he told himself quickly, but the chill within him would not subside. The latch on the door jiggled as hands worked quietly to free it. Amberlee was awake as well, sitting next to him, her face white within the shadow of her long chestnut hair. Will put a finger to his lips. Wait here. Silently, he slipped from the bed and moved to the door. The latch continued to rattle, but the veilman had thrown the bolt above it so the room was secure. He bent toward the doorway and listened. The voices without were low and muffled.
Careful, fool. Just lift it. I am lifting it. Step out of the light. Waste of time. Just break it in. There's enough of us.
Not if he uses magic.
The gold is worth the risk. Break it.
The voices argued on, whispers laced with the slur of ale, mixed with grunts and ragged breathing. There were at least half a dozen men out there, the veilman decided. Thieves and cutthroats, most probably, undoubtedly led to them by the idle tongue of someone who had heard the tale of their miraculous cure of the proprietress of the inn, and who could not resist a few embellishments in a retelling of the story. He backed away hurriedly, groping for the bed. Amberlee's hand gripped his arm. "We have to get out of here," he whispered. Wordlessly, she moved off the bed into the dark. They had slept in their clothes, and it took them only moments to pull on the travel cloaks and boots. Will hastened to the window at the rear of the room and pushed it open. Immediately below, a veranda roof sloped downward from the wall. From its edge, there was a drop of a dozen feet to the ground. Will turned back to find Amberlee again and brought her to the window. "Out you go," he whispered, and took her arm. In that same instant there came a loud oath from the hall, and a heavy body crashed into the door, splintering boards and metal fastenings. The would-be thieves had lost their patience. Will all but shoved the elven girl through the open window, glancing back hurriedly to see if the intruders had broken through completely. They had not. The door still held. But then the door was struck again. This time the bolt gave way. Into the room surged a knot of cloaked figures, stumbling over one another, cursing and yelling. Will did not wait to see what might happen next. Scrambling through the window, he leaped hurriedly onto the veranda roof. "Jump!" he yelled to Amberlee, who crouched in front of him. The elven girl slipped over the edge of the roof and dropped to the earth below. In a moment's time, Will was beside her. Above them, leaning through the open window, the cloaked figures shouted in anger. Will pulled Amberlee back within the shadows of the building, then looked about hurriedly. "Which way?" he muttered, suddenly confused. Wordlessly, Amberlee took his hand and sprinted to the end of the wall, then broke for the building next to the inn. The shouts of their pursuers rose sharply, followed by the sound of booted feet on the veranda roof. Veilman and elven girl ran silently through the darkness of the buildings, slipping down passageways, through alleys, and along walls until at last they were back to the edge of the main roadway. Still the shouts pursued them. Grimpen Ward seemed to come suddenly awake, lights flaring in darkened buildings all about them, voices raising in anger. Amberlee started out onto the roadway, but Will pulled her hastily back. Less than 100 feet away, in front of the candlelight inn, several dark forms fanned out onto the road, searching carefully the shadows about them. "We have to go back," the veilman whispered. They retraced their steps, following the wall of the building until they reached its end. A series of sheds and stalls stood clustered together against the dark backdrop of the forest. Will hesitated. If they tried to escape into the forest, they would become hopelessly lost. They had to work their way back around the buildings to where the main roadway wound south out of Grimpen Ward. Once beyond the town, they would probably not be pursued further. Cautiously, they moved along the rear of the building. Walls and fences hemmed them in on all sides, and barrels of trash cluttered the path forward. But the shouts had quieted now, and the buildings ahead were still dark. A few minutes more, and they might be clear of their pursuit. They turned down a narrow alley that ran through a row of stables behind a feed store. Horses whickered softly at their scent, stamping impatiently within their stalls. A small paddock stretched out before them beyond a line of sheds. Will started along the paddock fence with Amberley at his side. They had taken no more than a dozen steps when a sharp cry went up behind them. From out of the shadows of the feed store, a dark form appeared, arms waving, voice raised in alarm. Answering cries sounded from the buildings beyond. Startled by the suddenness of their discovery, Veilman and Elven Girl stumbled over one another in their haste to flee, lost their footing, and went down. Instantly their pursuer was on top of them. Arms flailed and fists pummeled wildly. Will grappled with the man, a wiry fellow reeking of ale, as Amberley rolled clear. His hands fastened on his attacker's cloak. With a sudden heave, Will threw the man sideways into the paddock. There was a sharp whack as the man's head struck the fence boards and he collapsed in a heap. Will scrambled back to his feet. Lights came on in the rooms above the feed store and in the surrounding buildings. In the darkness behind them, torchlight flickered through the night. Cries of pursuit sounded from everywhere. The Veilman seized Amberley's hand and they raced together along the ring of the paddock to the line of sheds. There they turned back toward the main roadway, following a narrow alley that ran between two shuttered buildings. Shadows darkened the passage and the two ran blindly, Will leading. Ahead, the earthen line of the roadway slipped into view. "Will!" Amberley cried out in warning. Too late. The Veilman's eyes were not as sharp as the Elven girl's, and he stumbled headlong into a pile of loose boards strewn across the alley passage. Down he tumbled, crashing into the side of the building. Pain exploded in his head. For an instant he lost consciousness completely. Then somehow he was back on his feet, weaving forward dizzily, Amberley's voice a faint buzzing in his ears. His hand reached for his forehead and came away wet with blood. Abruptly the Elven girl was next to him, her arms wrapping tightly about his waist. He sagged against her weakly, forcing himself to stagger ahead toward the distant light of the street. He felt himself blacking out again and fought against it. He had to keep moving. He had to keep awake. Amberley was talking to him, her voice urgent, but he could not make out the words. He felt like a fool. How could he have let something this stupid happen now? They staggered clear of the alley and turned into the shadows of a porch. Down its length they stumbled, the Elven girl fighting to keep the Veilman on his feet. Blood ran down into Will's eyes, blinding him further, and he muttered in anger. Suddenly he heard Amberley gasp in surprise. Through the haze that blurred his vision, he watched a tangle of shadows appear out of the dark. Voices sounded low and rough, and there was a hiss of warning. Then Amberley was gone, and he felt himself being lifted. Strong hands bore him quickly through the dark. There was a swirl of color before his clouded eyes, mingled with a rush of torchlight. Then he was being lifted again, this time through a narrow opening of canvas flaps. An oil lamp flickered beside him. Voices sounded, whispers of caution, and he felt a damp cloth wipe his face clean of blood. Hands worked busily to wrap him in blankets and to place a pillow beneath his head. Slowly, he opened his eyes. He lay within a gaily colored wagon, its walls decorated with tapestries, beads, and bright silks. The Veilman started. He knew this wagon. Then a face bent close, dark and sensuous, framed in ringlets of thick black hair. The smile that greeted him was dazzling. "I told you we would meet again, Will Ohmsford." It was Eritrea. Chapter 35. For 5 days, the army of the elves and the Legion Free Corps fought their way back across the Westland to Arbalon.
across the broad valley of the Serendanon, through woodlands dense and tangled, and down forest roads and rutted trails, they fell back slowly, steadily eastward, pursued at every turn by the demon hordes. They marched in daylight and at night, without rest, often without food, for the creatures that tracked them neither slept nor ate. Unburdened by human needs, free of human limitations, the demons came after them, purposeful, unrelenting, driven by their own peculiar form of madness. Like dogs at hunt, they harried the withdrawing army, nipping and slashing at its flanks, rushing it now and then in full assault, striving to turn it from its course, to cripple it, to destroy it. The attack was incessant, and the elves and their allies, already weary from their stand at bay and draw, grew quickly exhausted. With exhaustion came despair, and then fear. Andor Elicidal fell victim to that fear. It began for the elven prince with his own sense of failure. The dead, the defeats of the few days past, and all that the elves had hoped to accomplish and had not done haunted him. Yet even this was not the worst. For as his battered army struggled eastward and his countrymen continued to die all about him, Andor began to realize that none of them might survive the long march back, that all of them might die. Out of this stark realization was born the fear that became his own private devil, faceless, insidious, lurking just within the shadow of his determination. "Leader of the elves," it asked slyly, "what will you do to save them? Are you so helpless, then? So many have been lost. Yet what if all those who remain be lost?" It teased and tormented him, threatening to turn weary resolve into total despair. Even Alanon's presence did not help, for the black-robed druid stayed distant and aloof as he rode at Andor's side, veiled in his own world of dark secrets. So Andor fought his fear alone within the silence of his mind, the whole of his strength directed toward its defeat, as slowly, grimly, he led his failing soldiers back toward Arbalon. In the end, it was Ste Jans who saved them all. It was in this darkest time of seeming failure and desperation that the giant borderman displayed the tenacity, endurance, and courage that had created the legend of the Iron Man. Assembling a rear guard of elves and Free Corps, he began a defense of the main column of his army as it bore its dead and wounded eastward under cover of night. In a series of lunges and feints, the Legion commander struck out at his pursuers, drawing them after him, first one way, then another, utilizing the same tactics that he had so successfully employed at Bay and Draw. Time and again the demons came at him, sweeping first through the valley of the Serendanon, then into the forest land beyond. Time and again they sought to trap the fleet, gray-cloaked legion riders and the swift elven horse, always to close an instant too late, finding only an empty grassland, a blind draw, a hollow dark with shadow, or a scrub-choked trail that turned back upon itself. With a deftness that baffled and maddened the demons, Ste Jans and the riders following him played a deadly cat-and-mouse game that seemed to place them everywhere at once, yet always away from where the main body of the army moved back toward the safety of Arbalon. Demon anger and frustration mounted. As night became day and day night again, the pursuit grew frenzied. These demons were different from the lean, black creatures that had swarmed out of the hill country north of Bay and Draw to seize the Serendanon. These were demons that had gone east above the Kensrow, more dangerous than their lesser brethren, with powers that no ordinary human could withstand. Some were monstrous in size, corded with muscle and scaled with armor, creatures of mindless destruction. Others were small and fluid and killed with just a touch.
Some were slow and ponderous, some quicksilver as they slipped through the forest shadows like wraiths. Some were multi-limbed, others had no limbs at all. Some breathed fire as the dragons of old, and some were eaters of human flesh. Where they passed, the land of the elves was left blackened and scarred, ravaged so that nothing might live upon it. Yet the elves themselves remained just beyond their reach. The chase wore on. Elven hunters and Free Corps soldier fought side by side in a desperate attempt to slow the demon advance, watching their numbers dwindle steadily as their pursuers swept after them. Without Steed Jans to lead them, they would have been annihilated. Even with him, hundreds fell wounded and dead along the way, lost in the terrible struggle to prevent the long retreat from turning into a complete rout. Through it all, the Legion commander's tactics remained the same. The strength of the demons made it imperative that the elven army not be forced to stand again this side of Arbalon. So the rear guard continued to strike quickly and slip away, always to swing back for yet another strike and then another, and each time a few more riders were lost. At last, on the afternoon of the fifth day, the tattered and exhausted army came again to the shores of the Rilsong. With a ragged shout, it crossed back into Arbalon. Then it discovered the price that had been paid. A third of the elves who had marched west to the Serendanon were dead. Hundreds more lay injured. Of the 600 soldiers of the Legion Free Corps who had followed after them, less than one in every three remained alive. And still the demons advanced. Dusk fell over the city of Arbalon. The day had gone cool at its end, a bank of heavy storm clouds moving eastward out of the flats to screen away moon and stars and fill the night air with the smell of rain. Lamps began to light within the homes of the city as families and friends gathered together for their evening meal. On the streets and in the treeways, units of the home guard began their nightly patrol, slipping through pooled shadows in uneasy silence. Atop the Carolan, on the Elfich, and along the eastern bank of the Rilsong, the soldiers of the Elven army stood ready, staring past rows of iron stanchions filled with burning pitch to the blackness of the forest beyond. Within the trees, nothing moved. In the chambers of the Elven High Council, Andor Elicidal came face to face for the first time since his return from the Serendanon with the king's ministers, the army commanders, and the few outlanders who had arrived to aid the elves in their fight against the demons. He passed through the heavy wooden doors at the end of the council room, carrying the silver Elkris staff in his right hand. Dust, sweat, and blood covered the elven prince. While he had permitted himself a few brief hours of sleep, he had not yet taken time to wash, preferring to come as quickly as possible before the council. Beside him walked Alanon, tall and black and forbidding, his shadow rising up against the walls of the chamber as he entered, and Steed Jans, his weapons still strapped about him, his hazel eyes cold with death. From their high-backed chairs about the council table, the seats of the gallery, and the risers at the edge of the dais of the kings, those gathered came at once to their feet. A rush of whispers and mutterings filled the hall, and questions began to rise up in shouts as each man sought to be heard. At the head of the table, Amer Chios brought his open hand down upon the wooden surface with a crash, and the room went silent again. "Be seated," the First Minister directed. Grumbling, the men assembled did as they were told. Andor waited a moment, then came forward a step. He knew the rules of the High Council. When the king lay disabled, the First Minister presided. Amer Chios was a powerful and respected man, the more so in this situation. Andor had come before the council with a very specific purpose in mind, and he would need the support of Chios if he were to achieve that purpose.
He was tired and he was anxious, but it was necessary that he take time to go about matters in the proper way.
"My Lord First Minister," he addressed the minister, "I would speak to the council."
Emir Chios nodded. "Do so then, my Lord Prince." Slowly, haltingly, for he was not the speaker that his father was or his brother had been, Ander told of all that had befallen the elven army since its departure to the Serendanon. He described the injury to the king and the death of Arion. He told them of the battles and defeats at the Breakline, of the withdrawal and gallant stand at Bayendraw, and finally of the retreat back through the Serendanon and the Westland forests to Arbalan. He told them of the courage of the Legion Free Corps, the leadership of Stee Jans when Pindannon had fallen. Graphically, he described the nature of the enemy they had faced, its size, its shape, its frenzy, and its power. The demons, he warned them, now approached Arbalan, there to exterminate the last of the elven people, to lay waste to the city, and to take back again the land they had lost centuries ago. What lay ahead was a battle in which one or the other, elf or demon, must surely be destroyed. As he spoke, he studied the faces of his listeners, seeking in their eyes and expressions something of how they judged his actions since the loss of both their king and his heir apparent. He accepted now that his father might die, and that he might then be king. He knew that the High Council and the elven people must come to accept it as well. Acceptance had been difficult for Ander, because before the battle at Hallis Cut, the possibility of such a thing happening had always seemed so remote, and because he had not wanted to believe that he would lose both his father and his brother. But his father now lay within his bed at the manor house, unchanged since